Thank you very much, Rabbi Schwartz. I'll just take exception with the decades upon decades, not so many decades. It's not good. Existential angst aside, so many decades. I'm just kidding. The last time we had a shiur 2 weeks ago, we spoke about the value of life, and I'd just like to very, very quickly review and lead into tonight based on that understanding. We talked about the fact that we as Jews wake up every morning and the first thing we say is Moda Ani Lefanecha. We give thanks to God, we give thanks to Hashem for life. It's not for the golf we're going to play that day. It's not for the beautiful home we have or the nice car we drive or the success we enjoy, but rather Shehechazarta b'nishmasi. We give thanks for having our neshama, for having our soul, for the very fact that we are alive and we have opportunity to still grow. And we spoke about the fact that the value of life is really defined in its ability, in its opportunity that it provides for us to build and to prepare for a world that is after this world, that really this world is a preparation, this world is an anteroom, this world is a place where we prepare for the world to come, and that every moment in this life is irreplaceable. And every moment in this life is an opportunity for growth, and growth doesn't mean accomplishing great things. Growth is any act that we perform, any mitzvah that we perform, anything that we do that helps another person, anything that we do that is an act of sacrifice for the will of Hashem, for the will of God. And so we spoke about the value of each minute and how it affects the decisions that we have to make at the end of life, particularly where the secular world around us defines life in the quality of life. It defines life in what we can accomplish that is pleasurable, that is enjoyable, that gives us satisfaction in a physical sense, in a material sense, in a social sense, but not necessarily in the sense of being able to accomplish for eternity. And so that's the different perception that we have as Jews as to how to define the value of life. And so we spoke about the fact that the Jewish perspective of DNR orders, of do not resuscitate orders, of allowing someone to die with dignity, allowing them to die perhaps by holding back essentials like medication or hydration and nutrition, water and nutrients that they may need, and so on and so forth, when they are no longer functioning on a level that they would normally be functioning on, and so on, may be very different in Jewish law than it is in the secular law, in the secular world. Tonight's subject is entitled Paying Last Respects Respectfully. I think we really need, first and foremost, to understand what is the respect that we give someone after they have left this world, in the sense after their neshama, after their soul has departed, has separated from their physical being. What is the respect that we give them, and what is it based upon? What is the understanding of why this is respect? We're going to spend this evening and the next evening, next Monday of Mirtz Hashem. I don't want to say that for sure because last time I found out we had to suddenly cancel. But the fact is that we hope to spend tonight and next week explaining that. And I'd like to begin with a story that the Torah tells us And we're actually, the Torah first speaks about death, and actually not first, but many of the laws that we learn are learned from this particular episode. The first, it's in the very last parsha, the very last portion of Bereishis, of the first of the books of Moses, of Genesis, where the Torah tells us that Jacob, the last of the patriarchs, was about to die. And it tells us that he sent his grandson Ephraim to go back to his son Yosef. Ephraim's father was Yosef. And Jacob, who was learning, studying with Ephraim, sent Ephraim back to his father Joseph to tell him, Hine avicha chole, behold, your father is sick. Come quickly, your father is dying, your father is sick. And the Gemara tells us, the Gemara, I believe it's a Gemara in Baba Metzia, that tells us that Jacob was actually the first person in history up until that point to be sick. People weren't sick as we know it today. People were either alive, living, and when it came time to die, we are told in a number of places that people actually sneezed and they died. This is why up until this very day, when a person sneezes, we say labriut, we say gesundheit, we say whatever it is, zu gesund, if you speak Yiddish, whatever it may be. But the idea is, because this is where it comes from, people died by sneezing and their neshama left, and that was the end of life. Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, the last of the patriarchs, requested, the Gemara tells us, he asked of Hashem to give him a new concept, a concept of illness, to create something new. And so he became sick. And the reason for this was so that he would have the opportunity to prepare for the time after he died, so that it wouldn't just be a sudden thing and there would be no preparation possible, but rather he would have time to prepare himself as well as to prepare his family for that which will be after he passes on. And so it's very interesting, the Torah Tmima, one of the commentaries on the Chumash, explains, how did the Gemara learn, how did the Talmud learn from these words, behold, your father is sick, that he was the first person to be sick? How is that indicated? And it tells us a very interesting concept, and there are certain traditions that we follow based on that concept. There's a concept in Torah, a concept in Jewish thought, that we are not mevaser besura ra. We don't bear bad news. We are not to bear bad news. There are certain people that just can't wait to tell us, oh, did you hear what happened? So-and-so, you know, come running into the shul or into the center, whatever it may be, wherever people are gathered, into the store, into wherever, among friends. Look, listen, oh, did you hear what happened? She was walking, she went, terrible things happened. Okay? We're not supposed to be. In fact, there's a very interesting halacha, which we probably will not talk about next week and probably would fall through the cracks. But there is a minhag, there is a custom to open the windows in a house when a person died, and actually to pour water out of the window from where a person died. There are two separate things. You're supposed to pour out the water, you're supposed to open the window even if you don't pour out the water. But it is brought in the commentaries that the reason we did this was, there are a number of reasons, but one of the reasons was so that people would know that someone died. We weren't going to tell everybody and announce to everybody that someone died, because we're not supposed to bear bad news. So if someone saw the window open and they were pouring out water, they knew that someone had died in the house, and it needn't have to have been explained and told. People learned of this fact in a way in which they didn't have to bear bad news. Says the Torah Tamima, here we find in the Torah, Ephraim comes back to his father. Your father is sick. Hine avicha chole. Hey, how could he be the bearer of bad news? The answer was, because if he didn't tell him that, If he just said, your father is no longer well, he would have thought his father died, because the fact is you were either well or you were dead. There was nothing in between. So by telling him he's only sick, it was actually good news. This was the first time a person wasn't well, but he wasn't dead yet. He's still alive. He can still function. So actually, hinei avicha chole must have been good news. And that's because Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, prayed for this state of illness. He prayed to have the opportunity. So we can look at illness as a time to prepare. And we should look at illness as a time of opportunity. And the truth is that it is an opportunity. We spoke last week, I think I mentioned this last week, that many of the teachers of ethics point out that the process of aging is really a process of great kindness. We begin to slowly age, which reminds us that time is running out, that life is not forever, that life is not eternal, and it is time to do the things and accomplish the things that we were meant to do in this world, and to finally grow up and become serious and do some things other than for ourselves, but for God who put us here and for others around us. So there is a need to take the time to learn what is it that we need to know when a person is getting on. And one of the things that we need to do to prepare for the end of life and past the end of life and after life no longer is given to us, where we don't wake up and say Moda Ani. It's interesting that referring back to that story with Jacob and Joseph, it tells us that after Ephraim came to back to his father and said, your father is sick, he gave him, he summoned him to the bed of Yaakov, and Yaakov says to him, V'yasisa imadi, you shall perform with me chesed, kindness, ve'emes, and truth. We understand kindness, and what does he tell him to do? He says, don't bury me among the Egyptians. Take me, carry me to Eretz Yisrael, take me to the land of Israel, where you will bury me with my ancestors, with my parents. V'shachafti imavosai, I will lie with my parents, with Isaac and with Abraham, and ukvartani b'kfarasim, and you will bury me in the same cave where they are buried, which until this day we know where it is, in Hebron, in the Aras Machpelah, the cave of Machpelah. And so the question is obvious. We understand the kindness involved. What does it mean, perform with me kindness and truth? What is the truth that he asked him to perform? The kindness? Yeah, it's a long trip. It's not simple to take Joseph and Jacob and carry him all the way to Hebron from Egypt and bury him in this cave of Machpelah. But what is the truth? And the commentaries explain that kindness wasn't enough. We needed to have kindness that was guided by truth. Many of us, in fact all of us, I would say, when someone passes on, we want to be kind to them. We want to do what is, in our estimation, the most respectful thing to do. But if you ask five people, what is the most respectful thing to do? You'll probably get at least five answers, maybe more, but certainly five answers, because everyone, if it's objective, if it's subjective, then it's whatever I believe is the most respectful thing to do. And you needn't go any further than into a funeral home today, and you will find there's an entire list of things that you can have. Okay, you can be cremated, chas v'sholem, be cremated, you can be burned, you can be embalmed, you can be buried above ground, you can be buried below ground, you could be in an urn, you could be not in an urn, you could have the ashes sprinkled over the ocean, over your favorite flower in the backyard, buried, left in. Today, the latest thing, you read the newspapers, people's ashes are taken and compressed into a beautiful diamond. It looks like a diamond, and people wear it on their finger. I have mom right here. I can feel very close. This is This has been in the papers for a long time. This is all out of respect. Mom would have wanted to stay close. So you need not only kindness. What Jacob was saying is, you might think that the greatest act of kindness would be to build for me a great pyramid in my name. Joseph was the viceroy of Egypt. This was his father. He could have built for him the greatest monument that existed in Egypt. People in Egypt, from the Pharaoh on down, had great respect for Jacob. They would have done whatever he wanted. And he said, no, I don't want that kind of kindness. I want kindness that is guided by truth. And truth says that I should be buried in Eretz Yisrael with my parents, my grandparents, rather than to be buried in Egypt, where perhaps there were good reasons for him to be buried. The children, the grandchildren are all there, but there were reasons why it would be best not to bury him, and so the decision was to take him to Eretz Yisrael, to take him to Israel. It is important for us to know that we need to understand and to learn what is the truth that defines the kindness that we will do for others, and what is the truth that defines the kindness that we should be seeking for ourselves at the end of life. That's what we're going to try to discuss over the next class, the end of this class and the next class. But first and foremost, I think it is valuable, extremely valuable, that we not only learn the truth so that we know what needs to be done, but that we let the people around us know what is that truth that we have learned defines the kindness that we want. Because we can know it all and we can be very educated, but if the people around us who are going to make those decisions aren't aware of what is right, then unfortunately we will not necessarily be given the kind of respect that is defined by emes, that is defined by truth. There are now a number of organizations that provide what is called a living will. A living will. There's, by the way, the Agudat Israel of America, and by the way, one of the handouts you have tonight is a sheet that announces a new website. It's the website of our association, NASC.org. On that website, you can retrieve the living will of Agudat Israel of America, as well as the living will of the Rabbinical Council of America. They're slightly different, but each of them is valuable and valid. And the idea is that it defines the issues that require someone to make decisions who are knowledgeable. Okay? If we talked about do not resuscitate orders, all of the end-of-life issues, you need to designate someone who will be able to make those decisions and not leave it to the people who will be there to make those decisions, who may not know all the things that you have learned. So it's important to let them know, and the way to do so, the easiest way to do so, and the legal way to do so, is to fill out such a living will. And since a person never knows when that time will come where there would be a question of a DNR order, we get up every morning and say Moda'ani, because every morning we have to thank Hashem for being here. And we needn't look any further than any newspaper on any given day to learn of miners that are trapped and are perhaps no longer alive, and accidents, bridges that collapse, and just stories we hear of people who just don't wake up, young people, old people, accidents on the street. It's an endless way in which people's lives can suddenly change very drastically. So there's a need. It's very worthwhile to have this type of living will in place. There is a brochure that I gave out which explains a lot of the concepts we're going to be talking about, but in the back of it there is also not a legal living will, but a little form that at least is similar to a living will. If you can't get it off the website, at least to fill something like this out, which is very simple, which has all of the information that others will need at the time that a person's life is drawing to a close, with all of the basic information that one might need and how to get that information. Among the things that it says is who is a rabbi that should be called to make decisions, where a person's will is located. Again, you can have a living will, but if it's put in a drawer somewhere or in the somewhere in the glove compartment of some car that you haven't used in a couple of years, or somewhere in a drawer, well, no one will ever find it. It's not going to accomplish what it's meant to accomplish. People need to know. You can make copies of this. It can be handed out to people who may be in the position to have to make those decisions. I must tell you, I spent some time today on a case of a man. I'm very involved with an organization called Hebrew Free Burial Association. Many of you have probably heard of it. It's an organization that's been around for 100 years, over 100 years, and they bury people who are indigent. I brought it with me. I won't read the name. But this is, they faxed this to me. This gentleman, very Jewish name, aged 73, not a very old man, died on the 16th of May of this year. On the, what I have in front of me is a copy of a, it's a permit for a funeral director to claim his body. This took place on the 11th of June. The man was dead just about a little less than 4 weeks, okay? This man is still lying in a morgue in the Bronx, okay? But that's not the worst part. That wouldn't be so terrible, so we would bury him a few months late, but we would bury him. This allowed a funeral director, and we're trying to figure out how exactly this funeral director got the permission to do so, but this person picked up the body for the purpose of disposal, which is what this is a permit to do. It reads, permit to dispose of or transport human remains, okay? And where it's listed, method of disposal, there are three options: cremation, interment, and other. This was other. What is other? Anatomical, exactly. What they did was they basically harvested all this person's organs for whatever reason or other, and now he's just lying around a shell with nothing inside, waiting to be buried, and we're trying to at least get permission. Now, mind you, Hebrew Free Burial is having the hardest time because the public administrator and the medical examiner in the Bronx claim he's not under their jurisdiction because he lived in New Jersey. He happened to die in the Bronx, but he lived in New Jersey. New Jersey doesn't really want to get involved because he's in the Bronx. To give permission, I don't know how they got permission, to give a funeral director permission to harvest his anatomical parts for research was no problem, but to get him buried, we're running up against problems. But this is a man who I'm sure had a life and obviously did not leave directions. May have been a recluse, may have been a homeless person, I'm not sure. He obviously had an address in New Jersey, but there must be people out there who knew him at one time. But obviously he did not take the time to prepare and to let those people around him know what might have been his wishes regarding the end. And I must tell you, there are stories upon stories, not of such horrific nature, not of such extreme, but I remember myself, I'll never forget, there was a young boy who used to come to my shul. He was learning in yeshiva. His parents were a little less traditional than he was, and he wanted everything done right when his mother, who was very, very sick, passed away. And he came to my house on Shabbos one Friday night and he said to me, Rabbi, she died and everything is being done traditionally. I must tell you, the one thing he overlooked was the fact that he didn't mention to the doctors that they did not want to autopsy. And by the time Shabbos was over, this woman had been autopsied and many of her organs removed and so on and so forth. Okay, these are all things, reasons, examples. I'm just giving you a couple of examples of why it is so important to, first of all, understand the importance of these issues and understand why it's important not only to educate ourselves, but to educate or at least have some vehicle of notification to the people who are around us who will eventually have the need to make decisions at the end of life, prior to the very end of life or after life actually ends. Going into a nursing home. There are people who go into nursing homes and they might even express certain wishes to a social worker when they come into the nursing home. But if they don't have immediate family around them, that person leaves the nursing home and goes to a hospital, and 3 or 4 weeks later they die, the hospital may not even notify the nursing home. Which social worker in the nursing home is going to keep track of a patient that's already left after 4 weeks? That person may very well end up on such a piece of paper or in Potter's Field or whatever. Okay? These are issues that are real, and unfortunately they happen. And sometimes people live very long, and there is a disadvantage in that because they outlive all of their immediate circle of friends if they have no immediate family or if they're distanced from their immediate family and so on and so forth. So it's important, but it's important for all of us to have knowledge and to impart the wishes that we have based on that knowledge to those people who will eventually make those decisions. There's an interesting law that was passed in New York State. I think it was about a couple of years ago, but it's fairly recent. In New York State, the law was, and this is still the law, by the way, that when a person dies, the person who makes the decisions is not the person themselves. A living will goes a long way towards making it responsible for the person who has those decisions to follow the living will. But by and large, the law is that the next of kin is the one who makes the decisions. And if the next of kin, sometimes it's a second spouse, and sometimes there are differences between the, unfortunately, we live in a world where sometimes a second spouse could be more traditional, less traditional. Sometimes a second spouse could even be someone from another religion. We have cases like that even in families where the children are religious, but parents at a later time in life who are not traditional marry out of the faith and so on and so forth. Those are the people who are going to make these decisions. And very often they're going to make decisions based on what they feel is appropriate. Okay? The law, the way it was, there was a hierarchy of people who had the right of disposal. The hierarchy was, first of all, a spouse, husband or wife. Then it was parents, I believe, if there were still parents alive. Then children, then siblings. Then it goes to aunts or uncles, nieces and nephews. In fact, this law was originally written where they left out nieces and nephews and aunts or uncles or cousins. They just amended the law to bring them back. But what the law changed that is very important is the law created a new person who has the first power. And that person is called a designated agent. If someone designates an agent to be responsible for what is to be done when they pass on, that person actually has more power than even a spouse or even a child or even a parent. And it's important to know this. Sometimes that might be necessary. Okay, so this is a law that was passed and is in New York State, allows someone to designate an agent. In fact, we were looking to change that little page that says my burial wishes to actually comply with the law so that within that page we would be able to also designate an agent that would comply with this law and would allow us to make that designation all on that one page. We haven't yet done that. Bezrat Hashem, we hope to do so. So we need to designate someone that will make decisions prior to death, who will make the decisions as to what kind of medical care, what kind of medical procedures will be done at the end of life. We also need to designate someone that will know what to do post-mortem. We spoke a little bit about autopsy. Let me give you a little bit of background as to where we learn in the Torah about the requirement for respect for a person who died. After all, they're dead. I must tell you that I have had many conversations almost on a daily basis with funeral directors or with people about the kind of respect that is to be given to a person who died. And very often I get the feedback, they're dead. I got a call this afternoon, actually a couple of hours ago, from a woman out of town. I didn't even mention where she's from. She's from Baltimore. Someone in her family is very sick, and she's about to be faced with the loss of a parent who's going to have to be buried in New York. And the question was, whom should she contact? Should she contact the funeral director here? Should she contact the funeral director there? And then the issue came up about, how are we going to get this person from Baltimore to New York? Are we going to drive them up from Baltimore? Or are we going to fly them up from Baltimore? Okay? And I said to this person, I personally drive them up from Baltimore. In terms of the time, probably take less time. You have to be at the airport 2 hours before flight time. If it's going by cargo, you have to prepare it, you have to pack it. All the movement into a special box and all kinds of airport regulations until you pick it up from the airport. From Baltimore to New York, it's a three and a half hour trip. Have them drive it up. So the question came up, should someone go in the car with this person? Should there be a shomer? Should there be someone from the family or a watcher that goes along with this person from Baltimore? And I said to them, I would send someone along. I said, if for no other reason, I said, you're going to get the funeral director, they'll say, well, the driver's Jewish, it's okay. I said, that's fine. But what is this Jewish driver going to be doing while he's driving up from New York? He's going to be playing rap music, or he might be talking on the telephone in language that I don't think he would say if there was a family member sitting next to him. Okay? Now, how do we understand the body? There's a body in the back listening to the rap music, to the conversation, to the language. Is that kavod? Is that respectful? But the person is dead. The response I get, he's dead, she's dead. What's your problem? So let me explain to you how the truth defines the respect. It's very fascinating that the Torah chooses to teach us the laws of burial in a very interesting place. It happens to be the portion, not this coming Shabbos, but a couple of weeks down, the Shabbos after that. And it tells us that if there was a man, I think I might have even mentioned it, if there was a man who was to be put to death, the court decided that the crime that he committed, he was guilty of, and it's a crime punishable by death, he's to be killed, and he's to be hung. This is what was done for certain people who died. As an example, the purpose of killing was not only a punishment, but was meant to teach society what certain acts lead to and how bad and how despicable these acts are. And so he was hung out. And then the Torah tells us, Lo solin ivloso alo eitz, do not allow his remains to stay on the gallows overnight. Ki kavod tikberenu b'yom ahu, bury him on that day. And it gives us a reason. ki kililas Elokim tolui, because the curse or the shame of God is hanging. This is not just a body hanging out there. This is someone created in the image of Hashem, someone created in the image of God. And if you look at Rashi, you look at the commentary, it's fascinating. Rashi gives us an explanation. He says, you know what this is compared to? He said there were twins. One of them became the king, and one of them became the head of the mafia. One of them became the Don. Okay? And he was captured. This bandit was captured, and he was hung. This was his punishment. People walking by or riding by or watching this, what do they see? The identical twin of the king. The picture of the king hanging. Oh my, the king is hanging. That's how Rashi defines this particular passage in the Torah. A person hanging. What person are we talking about? A person who is deserving of death. And if you read the Gemara teaches us, the Talmud teaches us, that people weren't just put to death on a daily basis. It was very rare. And we looked to find any kind of reason why this person was deserving to be spared. Even if he was guilty or she was guilty, we spared their life if we could find any mitigating factor. But this person was hung. And he couldn't find a mitigating factor. This person is the image of God that is hanging out on the gallows. We never lose that. And we need to give respect to every person, even such a person. And that's where the Torah teaches us the respect that we're to give to people who die. Because each of us are created in the image of God. We carry a soul that is part of Hashem. And so we are to be given great respect. But what happens when a person dies? How do we understand what happens? You understand that this body is very, very worthy. This body was created by God in the image of God. It carried the neshama of God. It carried the soul that is a part of God. But what happens when a person dies? What happens? The body no longer functions. It's lying there, can no longer do all the things that it could do. Okay? What about the neshama? Where is the soul? The soul is that life force that somehow allows us to do the things that we do. There is a separation of the spiritual and the material. But where is that neshama? Where is that soul at this time? And the answer is, the neshama is right there. The soul does not depart on high instantly. The soul, we sneezed and the soul departed. We weren't sick. It was a sneeze. A person just didn't wake up. It was a momentary thing. Immediate death. And now the neshama suddenly transported up into the heavens, gone to a spiritual world. The fact is that the neshama, the soul, is there. There is a separation between the physical and the material, but the neshama, the soul, is very present with the body. And there is a fascinating article, which if you haven't received it yet, you will be able to pick up later, called Immortality in the Soul, written by one of the most prolific writers of recent generations, a fellow by the name of Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, who many of you seem to be familiar with. It's called Immortality in the Soul, and in it he defines exactly what happens according to the Midrash and the Talmud and the Kabbalah and so on. And he says, just in part, you could read it, and he says it a lot better than I could say it, but here is the gist of it. He says, when we are alive, our physical bodies have a tendency to restrict how much we can think of at any given time. We are restricted to thinking about what's in this room right in front of us. I'm speaking to you, you're listening to me, you might be aware of your neighbor, you might be conjuring up a thought from your past or some thought that might apply to what we are discussing. But by and large, all of the experiences of your life are in the recesses of your mind. They're there for instant recall if you need them. Hopefully, as we get older, it's not so instant. But the point is that it's there, but it's restricted by our physical being so that we don't have all kinds of thoughts flying through our heads at one time. We're able to place them in some kind of order, in some kind of sequence, so that we could deal with them in a way in which humans can deal with it. When the neshama, when the soul leaves the body and there is no longer a physical restraint, there's no longer a confinement to a physical body, the neshama, the soul, is now the total experience, the total knowledge of everything that happened in your life, all flooding in at once. Something that the neshama has a hard time dealing with. It's something that it hadn't experienced for a while. And on top of that, let's think about it. Let's go back to last week's lecture. Here we are in a world of opportunity for 60, 70, 80, 90 years. And suddenly, we are removed from that world of opportunity. There is a sudden flow of incomprehensible sense of loss. A sense of loss that is beyond anything we can really conceive of. I can't do it anymore. Oh my, I've been taken away from that world of opportunity where 1 minute is so valuable, because in 1 minute you can achieve eternity. And now here I am facing that eternity. I would have done this, I would have done that, I wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't have done this. It's all there coming in at once. And there is an unbelievable sense of anguish over loss of opportunity. And there's a disorientation because the neshama is not used to being in this physical, in this spiritual state. So what Rabbi Kaplan describes is that one of the things that the neshama focuses on at that time is the body itself. Because the body is where it lived for all these years. It focuses on the body. And what happens to the body is of great importance to the neshama. But think about it. Here is this neshama. It's now outside this body. What does it want to do? It wants to move on. It wants to move on to the next stage. Because being here is disorienting. Being here keeps it attached to the material world, and it's no longer material. It wants to move on. There is a statement that is said from one of the great tzaddikim of the recent, great scholars of the recent past, the Panevezh Rav, the rabbi who created the yeshiva of Panevezh in Bnei Brak, who once said that if a person understood the feeling of the neshama, at the feeling of the soul at the time of death, they would want to be buried right where they are. Just open a hole and let me go in and let me move on, because the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. The neshama can only move on after that process of burial has taken place. But let's think about this neshama in this car, listening to rap music, listening to someone wasting their life and using that beautiful gift that we're given, the gift of speech, where we can talk to Hashem, where we can thank Hashem, where we can pray to Hashem, where we can make another person feel good, we could teach others, and using it for profanity or for stupidity or for talking about people badly. The pain is so much more emphasized. It kind of brings to bear all of the sense of loss that this person had so much more so. It underscores it so much more so. And is the neshama, is the soul concerned now, even if the person is listening to a nice program? We're just talking about events of the day. The supermarket sales, the car lease that's on right now, that a great deal on a car lease. What is it to this neshama who is now in a... Anybody want to change this? Which is now in a different situation. Which is now in this very, very serious state of being. And by the way, there are so many of the halachos, so many of the laws and the customs that we follow are based on this concept of the neshama being present. I do not wear my tzitzis out. I don't know if any of you noticed, oh my, he's a rabbi, doesn't wear tzitzis out. I don't wear my tzitzis out. The reason I don't is because I'm in and out of funeral homes all the time. And we don't wear our tzitzis out in the presence of a person who died. They can't wear tzitzis anymore. Do you remember the story we told last 2 weeks ago about the rabbi who cried on his deathbed because he couldn't buy a pair of tzitzis for a few pennies? Here's the neshama, I can't wear that tzitzis anymore. It's like walking into a hospital room where someone just had a feeding tube put in and you come in with a big hero sandwich. Mm. It's how insensitive can you be? So the neshama is in this state and every minute is important. Getting it buried. I often speak to funeral directors and what they say to me is, Rabbi, funerals are for the living. It's for the family. The dead are dead. Funerals are for the living. That is our society's perception. Funerals are to make the living feel better. We can not take care of our loved ones perhaps the way we should have, and then we come to a funeral, we buy them a big box and a big bouquet of flowers and we make them up and they look great and we feel much better. But is that giving kavod? Is that doing kindness guided by truth? Not really. Is that what's important to this neshama, to this person at this time? And the body is a person. A person who is perhaps more sensitive than any living person could ever be. It's this person's whole life experience right there, living all their life constantly. And knowing the truth of life, knowing what is real and what is not real, knowing what is important, what is not important, being exposed to the ultimate reality. And that's how we approach giving kavod, giving respect, respectfully. But we need to know that in order to begin doing that, we need to learn, and we need to impart our knowledge, and we need to prepare. Because when a person dies, there isn't always time to do things appropriately. And if there is going to be the time, sometimes it could extend another day. And sometimes it's more than another day. Not only in the case that I just read to you about, but in a normal situation, someone dies on a Friday morning at 6 a.m. If they have prepared, they can be buried by 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. If they haven't prepared and there's no grave, and no one knows what to do or where to go, did they have a grave, didn't they have a grave, what did they need to do, then chances are you're talking about waiting till after Shabbos. Well, guess what? A few weeks from now, we're going to have Rosh Hashanah. And it's going to be a three-day Yom Tov. So if it happens on Erev Rosh Hashanah, you're talking about a four-day delay. And what if it's Erev Sukkos? And what if the person is going to Eretz Yisrael, but nobody knows, do they have a grave, don't they have a grave? They once said they may want to go to Eretz Yisrael, and now it's Erev Sukkos, the last flight left, or it's the day before Erev Sukkos. But it could be a difference. If you have everything set, you can get on that last flight. If you don't get everything set, it means waiting till Chol HaMoed. That's 4 days. And then the family doesn't sit Shiva until after the Yantif. That's the law. We'll talk about it more next week. But these are the ideas so you understand the importance of pre-need, of being prepared in advance, and why these things make so much difference in a very real way that we never think about. But if we understand where the kavod comes from and what it means for not just the memory of the person, not just because he once contained the neshama, she is created in the image of God. It's because it is them. They are here. They're very much in need of our assistance, of our respect. But it's not only kindness, it's kindness guided by emes, guided by truth. Autopsy, I'm going to talk about very quickly. But autopsy is something that in Jewish law is looked down upon. And there are instances where we have no choice because there is a question of homicide where federal law requires autopsy. But let me explain to you that there are two parts to autopsy. There is one part of autopsy which is strictly desecration of the body, which means cutting into a human being. It's contrary to Jewish law. This person is the Tzelem Elohim, created in the image of God, just like that guy hanging out there. We don't cut into a person. It's not just the body. The neshama feels pain watching its habitat of all these years being desecrated and cut. But there's another issue completely that's a separate issue. And that is the issue of when a person is autopsied, more often than not, much tissue and blood is lost in the process. Autopsies are generally done on a table which has a drain on the bottom. They use hoses, and as they cut the organs, pieces are lost. No one cares. It's not, there is no interest in that. It's a body. It's not viewed by truth. So besides the issue of cutting, there is an issue of loss. And the Torah tells us, bury him on that day. Him includes him and her and every part of him and her, even the blood, which is part of the body, it's an integral part of the body, is not to be lost. And so we created, interestingly enough, about 15 or 20 years ago, I created, at the request of the medical examiner in New York, a set of protocols that when an autopsy needs to be done, how it can be done in a way that would minimize the amount of desecration and minimize the amount of loss of tissue and so on, so that at least it would be done with the greatest possible respect under these terrible circumstances. How many newspaper articles and stories and pictures did we see of people in Eretz Yisrael digging up earth where there were accidents, where there was bombers, bombings, and all kinds of tragedies, digging up to make sure that all the blood was gathered, and certainly pieces of tissue, heroics, climbing on buildings. Why? This is a Tzelem Elohim. This is a person created in the image of God. So last week, I'll just very briefly apologize for not being here, but tell you where I went. I got a call from Agudath Israel of America that there was a conference taking place on an Air Force base in Washington, D.C. for Air Force chaplains, not just Jewish chaplains, but chaplains of all faiths, and that Agudath Israel was invited to make a presentation on a concept called virtual autopsy. And there's an article that you have, it's an article I think from HaMishpacha about a year ago. There was actually one more recently that I didn't have a chance to copy for you. But this is a new concept. We now have MRIs and CAT scans where we can get much information without having to cut into a person. And even if you have to, so my job at this conference And by the way, the reason we went to this Air Force base was because the military, the United States military for the past 2 years has been doing a study on every single body that comes from Iraq and Afghanistan. They are doing an autopsy, which they've always done, and they are also, before the autopsy, putting this body through a CAT scan and an MRI, or at least a CAT scan, the most advanced CAT scans, to be able to see what are the comparisons of information that they can glean from a virtual autopsy as opposed to an invasive autopsy. And I got up to speak on behalf of the Jewish community to explain to them why another cut, another piece of tissue taken, is another affront, is another desecration. And even if virtual autopsy will only mean limiting the amount of invasiveness, that would be a tremendous accomplishment. And explain exactly the issues I just explained to you, of how we view a person after death and what the requirements of burial are according to Torah law. So this is why I felt it was important to skip the class. It was Tuesday morning was the presentation, and this is why we're a week behind. But the idea is that we need to know that autopsy, and I must tell you, that doctors will very often send people on a guilt trip. If you allow us to autopsy this person, your children and grandchildren will very likely be spared certain genetic imperfections, or they will be able to know of genetic imperfections that will be able to allow them to prevent early death, and so on and so forth. Or we really have not had so many cases exactly like this, and this person died of Alzheimer's, and so why don't we just take a look and see what we can learn? But there are thousands of people out there with Alzheimer's. Why should we allow a person to be desecrated and not brought to burial in many ways? It's a tough question. Why should we benefit from other people? But the idea is, to us, this is our requirement. And I will tell you that at times where doctors have put me against the wall and have said to me, Rabbi, isn't it unfair that Jewish people benefit from autopsy, but you won't allow us to do the autopsy? And I say, you're right. But you know what? Take a look at the medical world in this country. Look at the hospitals. It's Beth Israel. It's Mount Sinai. Look at the names. It's the Klingenstein Pavilion. It's all the Jews who have given their wealth, who are the philanthropists, way beyond their numbers, way beyond the percentages. That's our contribution. It's the doctors. It's the Salks and all those great doctors who gave us the contributions. That's our contribution. This is something we can't contribute. Others will have to contribute that. But to say to us, we're to feel guilty? I don't feel guilty. We do what's right. So know that autopsy is something that is contrary to Jewish law. And to understand that autopsy has very significant implications and ramifications for the neshama as well as for what is required to give a person their respectful burial. Before a person dies, I'm going to just go about another 5 or 10 minutes, but try to bear with me. I know we're running a little late. We started a little late. There is a concept that before a person dies, we give them their last rites. And it's an extremely important concept. A person has the opportunity in one moment to ask forgiveness. It's an opportunity to have another Yom Kippur and another Ne'ilah, another closing prayer on Yom Kippur once more before they die, to say, God, I am sorry for the things that I did that are wrong, that were wrong, that perhaps I didn't use the opportunities I was given as I should have. And that sense of regret and that sense of atonement can give a person eternity. It's a wonderful opportunity. And by the way, a person doesn't have to die after they take their last rites and they ask to be forgiven. Many people have, in fact, asked forgiveness thinking they were going to die. We spoke about a woman who, I don't remember if I spoke about it here, I think I might have mentioned it the last time, a woman who said vidui many times, leave it in your last will, let people know that this is something you would like to be done. And if a person's in a situation where they can no longer speak, say it for them. Have someone say it for you. If you hear it and you think along with it, that's all it needs. I'll tell you an unbelievable story that has tremendous implication. I think it's worth taking the couple of minutes to tell it. There was a man in my shul. He was a butcher. He was the Gabbai Sheni. He was the second Gabbai in my shul, of which I was the rabbi, when I first came. And about 4 or 5 years after I was in the shul, this man had a stroke. I was still studying in yeshiva at the time. I was still going to yeshiva. And he was in Jamaica Hospital, which is close to where I live. And every Tuesday night, I would go visit him in the hospital. And one night I was there, another part of the story very briefly, he was married for the second time, and his wife and his son were fighting over his inheritance in the room, arguing right here and there about what they were going to do when he died. And I would always tell them, what's the matter with you? And his wife would say in Yiddish, Was weiß er schon tot? He's dead already. What does he know? Brain dead. He had a stroke. Absolutely no recognition, no anything. They were waiting for him to die. This was before DNRs. This was before quality of life was an issue. This was before maybe right around the time of the Quinlan case, the Anne Quinlan case. But whatever it was, hospitals were still taking care of people and tried to prolong life. I walked in one Tuesday night, and thank God they were not there. And while I was there sitting with him, suddenly he stopped breathing. And they called a code on him. And all the doctors came running, and they brought him back to life. And I said to myself, how much do you need to see before you know the man is going to die one of these days? So I ran home, got my rabbi's manual, sat down with him on his bed, and I said, let me give him his last rites. I took his hand, and I said to him in Yiddish, Julius, I'm going to say vidui with you. I'm going to ask forgiveness with you. And I told him what we're supposed to say. Saying vidui doesn't mean that you're going to die. You could very well still recover. If anything, it's a merit to ask forgiveness. And if you don't say vidui, it doesn't mean you're going to get well. And I will tell you that as soon as I said the word vidui, this man, who had been in a coma for probably 3 months or better, brain dead on all accounts, who had just been through a code not long before, grabbed my hand with such force. He was a very powerful man, that's why I tell you he was a butcher. Very strong man. And he grabbed my hand with such force that I was convinced, the thought that went through my mind, you think strange things sometimes, was if he dies now, they're going to have to cut off his hand to get me out. The thought that went through my mind. Can imagine the grip that this man had. But I'm telling you, this is not, it wasn't funny. I sat with him for about 10 minutes and I said vidui with him slowly. And I must tell you that the grip never weakened until I was finished saying vidui. And I am convinced there was no question that this man knew what I was doing. Imagine 3 months dead, they're talking about his will and his inheritance, fighting in front of him, the pain this man must have been going through. I don't know if he was always lucid, but I know he was lucid then. Couldn't show me a thing. Looked as blank as he did all the other time. But there's no question that that grip came from somewhere. So vidui is a tremendous opportunity and something we should be aware of. What? You can put that in the living will. You can add whatever you want to a living will that someone should say, a rabbi should say, vidui with me. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a fine thing to do. not in there necessarily, but it's fine. Just this little burial thing that I have, Jewish names. Do you know how many people I call? Their children don't have the vaguest idea of what their Jewish names are. Oh, we'll see if we can find the ketubah. Do you think it would be on my naming certificate or my bar mitzvah certificate or maybe the father's name and not the mother's name? Forget about it. Okay, let people know your Jewish name. They can name grandchildren after you, whatever it may be. These are just little things. I once had the opportunity, a great opportunity, to speak with a great tzaddik, whose name was Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was a great tzaddik. He passed away about 20 years ago. And I had the opportunity to spend some time with him. And in our conversation, he said the following statement to me. There is one great mitzvah. We all know that a kohen, someone from a priestly family, is not permitted to go to a funeral. They're not permitted to go to cemeteries. They can't defile themselves. They did the work in the Beis HaMikdash in the Holy Temple, and until this very day, a Kohen can't go to a cemetery. The high priest was not even permitted to go to the funeral of his immediate family. A regular Kohen can go to the funeral of his family. A high priest couldn't even do that. But if the high priest is walking in the forest and finds a body that has no one to bury them, the high priest is obligated to defile himself. It could be Erev Yom Kippur. It could be the day before Yom Kippur, and the high priest is the only one who can do the service. He has to defile himself and bury that person. It's the image of God. Okay? Said Rabbi Kamenetsky to me a fascinating statement. He said, do you know who constitutes a meis mitzvah, a body without anyone to bury it in this country? In America today, we don't find bodies in the forest. Who is a meis mitzvah? Who is a body that needs to be buried? His answer was, every Jew who dies. It's fascinating. And as I've gone through those decades and decades, I have learned the truth of those words. Because we never know. Like this guy who came to me Friday night and was so excited that his mother had agreed to be buried traditionally and everything was going to be done right, but forgot to mention autopsy, and they autopsied her before Shabbos was over. Okay? In America, all kinds of things can happen. And certainly in our world today, in our world today, where there is a 30% rate of cremation in the Jewish community. Among the Jews in the world out there who are unaffiliated, 30% of Jews are being buried, are being cremated. That is the consensus. That is what is believed to be out there. In New York, it's less. Out west, it's much higher. But that's the consensus, about 30%. And of those who aren't, how many of them end up lying around for weeks or days? We have a case right now. We have a case right now. We have been providing a shomer at one of the funeral homes in Long Island for a total now of, I think, 7, 8 days. Someone in the family couldn't make the funeral, so they're holding this body for 8 days. They're doing it traditionally. They're having a shomer and the traditional preparation. But she's lying around for 8 days. They're finally burying her tomorrow. Okay? This is the world in which we live. Above ground burials, which are not burials. We'll talk about that. But the idea is that we need to know and we need to prepare. And it's extremely important to do so. So understand the issues. Cremation, we'll talk about more next week. Next week we will try to give the reasons behind a lot of the things that we have, that we do, the traditions that we do, not only the philosophical reasons, but also the practical reasons, and hopefully we'll be able to cover most of them, and we'll be able to get a complete overview of all of those issues.